cooperation, exchange and trade. Even so advanced that we could say they are considering a currency alternative to the hegemonic dollar, as seen in the case of BRICS, or particularly Russia and Iran have common currency for all types of trade. So I believe this is part of the political processes within countries that accompany this new way of understanding international relations, particularly multilateralism, towards mechanisms that ensure strong structures against what the American empire represents. I think they go hand in hand, but the extent or the main objective will determine the outcome. As you rightly pointed out, a center government, a leftist one or a right-wing one, can significantly influence how much a country participates in that multilateral scenario, or how much it even withdraws, like the despicable Bolsonaro did when he suspended Brazil from SELAC at the time, or when they created that blatantly unconditional experiment of the United States called PROSUR, which supposedly aimed to find alternatives for their countries, but in reality, it was about sabotage, and they ultimately succeeded in that regard.
That's right. Nayar, let me give you the following example. In Chile, there is some debate about whether or not to join the BRICS. And it's interesting to see that there are sectors of the upper bourgeoisie that even view joining the BRICS positively. The question is, who benefits from fairer trade and more reciprocal relationships rather than subjugation? How does that translate to the people, to the sectors that are currently marginalized, or continue to earn the same as always, as long as there is no change in social organization or a different political direction in the country? So yes, these organizations are good, but it depends on who is in government, don't you think?
¿Cuál es la experiencia?
Sí, no, totalmente de acuerdo con tu planteamiento porque...
I completely agree with your perspective as it mirrors the situation in Mexico. In other words, we have a government that has been promoting some very significant initiatives, such as the recent election of the judiciary, which is a landmark event in the region, alongside Bolivia, which has been doing this for some time. However, the internal economic order remains just as it was during the neoliberal era. To put it differently, macroeconomics is the crucial element that needs attention. While there is social redistribution through various programs, the capitalist system persists unchanged, and we still have a small portion of the society earning $1 million every hour, contrasted with 50 million people living in poverty and facing inequality, as well as the violence we are experiencing in our country, for instance. Indeed, the scenario you present is the same. Being part of the BRICS does contribute to reorganization, so to speak, of international economic relations, reducing the influence and significance of the United States in these relationships. However, if the international economic order itself is not altered, if the capitalist system is not changed at both the national and global levels, then the social conditions in our nations will not fundamentally improve. There may be social programs, scholarships, and various initiatives that can serve as temporary relief or be seen as redistribution, but ultimately, the root causes of inequality and marginalization inherent in capitalism in countries like ours remain unaddressed. In this regard, I believe that while all these mechanisms are indeed beneficial and important, they must also reflect a deeper internal change in our countries through structural reforms, rather than relying solely on good social policies, which could easily be dismantled by a right-wing government, leaving everything unchanged.
Puede venir un gobierno de derecha a desmontar toda esa estructura y no pasó nada, ¿no?
Así es. Ahora...
That's right. Now, is there a reference point, for instance, with the experience of the non-aligned countries at that time, that movement? Can we discuss multilateralism during that period?
Sí, por supuesto. Yo creo que fue una experiencia muy importante que reflejó...
Yes, of course. I believe it was a very significant experience that reflected how a strong alliance was empowered, let's say, among countries that shared similar political, economic, and social realities. And additionally, it occurred during a time when this intense phase of colonialism was also coming to an end. although it hasn't completely finished, as there are still 20 territories in the Caribbean under neocolonial conditions. However, at that time, the non-aligned movement represented the possibility of coexistence among nations without the dominance of the two power poles that existed back then, one of which is now clearly identified as the United States. This bears some resemblance, for instance, to BRICS, but I think the current mechanism that best embodies the spirit of the non-aligned movement, even reflecting what the Mutual Economic Assistance Agreement represented in the socialist bloc, is ALBA. To me, ALBA represents the Bolivarian alternative for the peoples of our America, fully known as the Treaty of Commerce of the Peoples. It seems to me to be the most advanced multilateral mechanism and asks for integration in the world, to the extent that it is not a mechanism that serves the economic interests of imperialism, but rather the social development of peoples and the reduction of asymmetries between countries.
Y para la disminución de las asimetrías entre países, ¿no?
Así es. Nayar, en una palabra para terminar.
That's right, Nayar. To sum it up, in one word, what does the future hold for the multilateralism movement?
Multilateralismo.
Pues creo que es bastante...
I believe it holds great promise. There are numerous opportunities to reshape power structures globally within a context of reciprocity, cooperation, solidarity, and respect. It's not about a relationship where military bases are used to coerce acceptance of a trade agreement, but rather about relationships where countries can engage in exchange and, most importantly, adopt a social perspective. That's how I see it.
Well, Nayar Lopez, a big hug to you. Thank you so much for being with us here on Black and White.
Likewise, Eduardo. It's my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Welcome to all our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. And here are some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning, the recitation of the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we'll listen to the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start this hour's lineup with the Ocean of Dua, which gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books, such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamelu Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will follow next. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning.
ocean of dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you in this edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition, we will try to talk about dozens of supplications from the Holy Quran that can be recited during the Qunut in everyday prayers and Salat. So stay with us. Dear brothers and sisters, we can also recite this verse, 126th verse of Surah Al-A'raf. رَبَّنَا أَفْرِغَ عَلَيْنَا صَبْرًا وَتَوَفَّنَا مُسْلِمِينَ. O our Lord, pour out on us patience and make us die as those who have submitted to you. Dear listeners, if hardship, poverty and discomfort and any kind of hardship come in your life, you as a faithful servant of Allah must recite this dua to have patience and self-control to remain firm on the right path and face the misfortunes boldly without ever showing any action that has been prohibited, so that you may leave this world as a true Muslim, submitting to the will of Allah. That's what this verse is trying to tell. The verse is implying that if we have patience by the side of the Almighty Allah, we have the ability to die as a true Muslim, to die as a true believer, to die as the one who has submitted to the Almighty Allah. رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. And one more point, dear listeners, regarding this verse. This verse was recited by some people. A group of master magicians, on the invitation of Pharaoh, came to show their superiority over Moses, or Musa, because Pharaoh wrongly thought that Moses was also a magician. The magicians threw a few ropes on the floor, and they took the shape of snakes. Moses put the staff he was holding in his hand on the ground, and the staff changed into a python. After it was changed into a python, it swallowed up all the snakes and ropes. Pharaoh got angry and threatened to kill them. Then these magicians came to know that Moses was not a magician, but a prophet of Allah. And when they saw this miracle of Allah, they laughed at Pharaoh and recited this dua, رَبَّنَا أَفْرِغْ عَلَيْنَا صَبْرًا وَتَوَفَّنَا مُسْلِمِينَ. O our Lord, pour out down on us patience and make us die as those who have submitted to you. May the Almighty Allah also make us die as those who have submitted to him. The next verse that we're trying to talk about in this program is this verse, 151st one of this very chapter. رَبِّ اغْفِرْ لِي وَلِي أَخِي وَأَدْخِلْنَا فِي رَحْمَتِكَ وَأَنْتَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. O Allah, forgive me and my brother and admit us to your mercy. You are the most merciful of the merciful. A true faithful must always recite this dua to seek mercy of the merciful Lord, particularly when he is in the middle of the unmanageable difficulties of his life. So when we face hardships, discomforts, and even poverty, we can recite this dua.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Aleem. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Tabeju shad abaz balava asra. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
Regarding this verse, dear listeners, to receive the Torah, Moses climbed the mountain of Tur and observed fast for 30 days, as directed by the Almighty Allah. Moses noticed that on account of fasting, his mouth was stinking, so he thought it was improper to pronounce the glory of Allah with a stinking mouth, and he brushed his teeth. This was considered an act of disobedience, and he was required to observe fast for 10 more days. After 40 days, Moses came back to his people with Torah, but he found his people worshipping the false god of the magician Samiri. Upon seeing this, Moses became angry and criticized his brother Aaron, Harun, who was acting as his lieutenant, some kind of a representative in his 40 days of absence. Aaron explained that he tried his best to keep them on the right path and warned these people against the tricks of the magician, but they paid no attention to his advice, so his brother, Moses, should have not included him in the group of the unjust followers. Moses, upon hearing the explanation of Harun, recited this dua, رَبِّ اغْفِرْ لِي وَلِي أَخِي. O Allah, forgive me and my brother, وَأَدْخِلْنَا فِي رَحْمَتِكَ, and admit us to your mercy, وَأَنْتَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. You are the most merciful of the merciful. It is highly recommended to read this dua in Qunut, in all prayers, dear listeners. May the Almighty Allah set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too
it was an aggression that broke international norms and laws. But when it comes to the Israeli regime, there is no law. There are no international norms. Targeted assassinations in an effort to impact Iran's military and nuclear apparatus failed. And this came at a cost for Israel, not only an economic one, but one that could have wiped it out were it not for the U.S. intervention. Israel's 12-day aggression, a 12-day war of aggression, parts of occupied Palestine completely destroyed from military bases to research centers. Economic costs is still being assessed. Israel's GDP shattered. Israel's economy contracts again, mounting war expenses topping $12 billion and looming public financial challenges. The Israeli economy is paying the price of the 12-day aggression. Economic crisis deepens. Meanwhile, the economic crisis deepens, capital flight and brain drain, with industries losing hope of recuperating their losses. It's now a fight for their survival. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Dr. Issa Bloomi, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University, and Diane Serre, political analyst and independent candidate for U.S. Senate from New York State.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and inshallah there will be peace for Iran and the larger region. Much of the economic model for the colonial state is one of subsidy. It draws enormous rent from the occupied territories, from stolen natural resources, but also huge amounts of support from Europe primarily, and especially the United States. The destruction of infrastructure and some of the older neighborhoods in cities like Tel Aviv and other towns, those will be targeted for rebuilding, reconstruction, with considerable economic benefits for those who are able to secure the contracts, the financing, and ultimately the new valuation of these properties. It's interesting to note that a lot of the people whose homes or businesses have been damaged or destroyed by this last small war will not get their properties back. This is kind of the quintessential disaster capitalism that will now kick in, and much of the older infrastructure is going to be rebuilt in a new way, and again, subsidized by outside investors.
This is a map of where the Israeli aggression targeted in the Islamic Republic, and one showing what areas Iran targeted and hit in the occupied Palestine. From a visual perspective, this is very effective, since it debunks any non-believers out there who think that Israel overwhelmed Iran. Plus, it shows how Iran shattered Israel's invincibility. Going into the Israeli aggression, Israel was suffering in different industries. As shown here, we picked three for you: tourism, construction, and agriculture. It is pretty obvious that tourism has suffered the most and continues to bleed since Israel's aggression and war seems to have no end.
There's going to be considerable amount of assistance coming from, in the shape and form of basically interest-free loans, which has always been the case for the Israeli economy, again, largely subsidized by the outside world. But because of the nature of the war itself and some of the infrastructure that was outdated and needed to be rebuilt anyways, I'm being very cynical about this, but also I see this as moving forward. There's going to be an opportunity to actually enter in and restructure some of these, especially service economies. There are probably going to be a push towards less labor-intensive service economies. One of the big issues that the Israeli economy will have moving forward is actually attracting labor, since the colonists themselves are not the most useful laborers in terms of construction, of agriculture, of tourism services. There will be a restructuring of especially tourism. There's going to be now, with the newly acquired Golan Heights, with the destruction and elimination of Gaza, there's going to be a period of heavy investment in construction and rebuilding, with a new kind of tourism awaiting in the after all this rebuilding takes place. That's if, of course, there's a stability moving forward. But I see this is just as a transitional phase, unfortunately, which, with the exception of a few small players, there's going to be a hell of a lot of money made on the back of suffering in the larger region, and it's going to be the usual suspects who are profiting from rebuilding a new kind of colonialist economy moving forward.
This is the social section of the program. Israel's economy is in shambles. They are in massive debt. Tourism is completely dead. The Houthis are damaging their economy. Massive boycotts globally are damaging their economy. And Israeli settlers are fleeing. The Zionist regime is crumbling. Israel went into a tailspin as the 12-day conflict with Iran has squeezed its economy dry, and experts say that it escaped an economic meltdown only because of the U.S. brokered the ceasefire. The real reason Trump and Netanyahu ended the war with Iran and are looking to end the genocide in Gaza are Israel's economy is hemorrhaging. The Iran 12-day way is estimated to have cost Israel's $4 billion on a conservative basis, a costly transformation of Israel's economic future is being driven by the war. This infographic visually unpacks the immense financial burden using key economic indicators to expose the true depth of the drain and the long-term price of the conflict.
I think Israel cannot afford it. I read recently that already in Israel, 20% of the population is below the poverty line. So this clearly is not affordable unless they are getting massive outside support. And even so, I don't know many people who wish to live in a war zone, and Israel. The point of Israel is that it's supposed to be a safe country. So I think this puts them in a very difficult situation.
The economic impact of the Israeli aggression on Iran left Israel facing billions of dollars in direct military expenses, economic losses, and a looming budget deficit, like spending $5 billion in the first week alone, $725 million per day in total war expenses. The total estimated impact is set to be $20 billion, a figure that is a guesstimate since the investigations are ongoing on the extent of the damage.
I think ultimately you must separate the survival of Israel from the political survival of its Prime Minister Netanyahu, who seems more interested in avoiding prison time than caring for the well-being of his population. What is urgently needed is a peace plan in the region, which includes a two-state Israel-Palestine solution based on the UN Resolution 242, the 67 borders, not an archipelago where the Palestinian people are not consulted, and then a massive region-wide infrastructure building program based on water, desalination, green the deserts. The former American President Eisenhower actually proposed three nuclear power plants in the region to desalinate water. This is the only way these industries can function, and it's impossible to function in that way when you're in a state of perpetual war.
This is the Info News section of the program, Economic War on Africa. The U.S. has just declared economic war on Africa. It will backfire, of course. To realize their full trade potential, African nations must address existing barriers and disjointed customs regulations. What Africa needs is regional trade and economic resilience. With a population and market of over 1 billion people, African leaders must shift focus and use regional instruments like AFCFTA to build and insulate the continent's economy. U.S.-Canada trade deal. U.S. ending all trade negotiations with Canada over digital tax. Bezos wedding. Jeff Bezos arrived in Venice for a wedding amid protests over inequality. Amazon tycoon married Lauren Sanchez in lavish Venice wedding as activists protest growing disparity. The affair is estimated to cost some $50 million. Now, NATO budget. NATO countries' budget compared defense versus healthcare and education. The decision by NATO members to spend 5% of their GDP on defense could shift budget priorities. NATO members to commit 5% of their GDP to defense spending means that for some countries, this would be more than they are spending on education and healthcare. This is the in-depth section of the program. This was no ordinary war. It was an aggression that was met by the wrath of Iran and its missiles, one in which Iran only used 5% of its capacity. The damage on the Israeli side so severe, Israel had to call a media blackout. But the footage didn't lie. The unseen damage was economic devastation. Energy annihilation. Haifa refinery, the fuel supply was torched. Dual power plant strikes pushed the national grid to fail. The results, economic paralysis, which was followed by rolling blackouts. There was also tech and research devastation. The Kiryat Gat was damaged. Intel's $10 billion fabs, short for fabrications or semiconductors, were frozen. As a result, 64% of exports were deemed dead. The Weizmann Institute, one of the world's leading multidisciplinary basic research institutions in the natural and exact sciences, its $500 million biomedical IP erased. Result, innovation economy is exposed as being extremely vulnerable. Actually, the financial carnage was laid bare to see. $5 billion wasted in week one alone. $725 million per day was the peak burn rate. There were $593 million per day on failed offensive strikes. And when it comes to the Iron Dome, $200 million per day. The result, $1.47 billion of civilian assets vaporized by Iran's sheer missile power. Now, let's bring back our guest, Dr. Issa Bloomi, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University. Dr. Bloomi, given that Israel is always at war, which means no investment, does that mean that there are no hopes for its economy to recover?
Well, again, some of the big players in the Israeli economy are often beneficiaries of extracting wealth from other parts of the world. One only thinks about the diamond industry or finance. But considering the territorial acquisitions, the more or less surrender, if you will, of the Arab world vis-a-vis the colonialist project, and the ability to exploit offshore resources, whether it be oil, gas, now that Israel occupies and will probably annex not only the Golan Heights, but significant parts of southern Syria, that it will mean it has full control over much of the region's water supply. This will mean the only issues that Israel's economy faces moving forward is the labor-intensive sectors of the economy, which may indeed be pushed aside for reconstruction, for oil and gas exploitation, for using its monopoly on water for a variety of purposes, and an expansion, if you will, using free credits from the United States and Europe, expanding their mining interests in Congo or other parts of Africa. So the big players are going to continue to win and actually will benefit from this war.
There was also a massive talent exodus that has been ongoing due to the Israeli genocidal war on Palestinians and the Gaza Strip. More than 80,000 citizens fled. This is the biggest outflow since 1948. Netanyahu banned dual nationals from leaving. He wouldn't even let Americans leave. He was desperate to stop the brain drain. Result, brain drain accelerating collapse. Iran achieved significant impact with minimal expenditure, inflicting an estimated $17.8 billion in damages. That is the equivalent of 3.3% of Israel's GDP. The conflict left Israel confronting a strained financial system, disruptions in insurance markets, and challenges to its international standing. And this map summarizes the depth of the destruction as outlined in this map of the occupied Palestine, from Haifa port and refinery to research and scientific centers to military bases, all hit with Iran's missiles that broke Israel's U.S.-made missile defense shields, a hammering that they need the U.S. to come and save it from near total destruction. Now, let's bring back our other guest, Diane Serre, political analyst and independent candidate from U.S. Senate from New York State. My question, Diane, given that Israel is in wars always, all the time, and this impedes investments in all of its sorts, does that mean that there are no hopes for Israel to recover, economically speaking?
As I said earlier, I think it is impossible to have an economic recovery when you are at war. War is very draining, very expensive, and it takes your most valuable resource, which is your people. I think if the United States were to work in a trustworthy fashion with China and Russia together and treat the region as a whole, that it would be possible to have peace and to organize for an economic recovery. Being in a state of perpetual war, contrary to the opinion of people like Senator Lindsey Graham, actually is not good for the economy, and it is not good for the stability and security of the planet as a whole.
Drone footage of occupied Palestine supports the deep destruction that Iran incurred under the Israeli regime in retaliation for the aggression it executed against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. president got one thing right. This was anger that was built up over 30 to 40 years. The winner was surely Iran, or else the Israeli regime would have gone for the kill. Now, countries from the east to the west, Asia, all agree on one thing. Israel is the source of instability.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast round the clock for listeners across the globe. The English channel of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting can be heard via shortwave, internet, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,710 kilohertz, every day on 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in the Southern Africa can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 11,740 kilohertz every day on 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Iran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means.
Thank you.
The Persian carpet has always received international praise, and that's because it's considered as the highest level of art, an artistic creation that has constantly improved and has become richer and more beautiful throughout the years.
The Persian carpet is a valuable piece of history. It's widely known for the beauty of its patterns, its intricately woven colors, durability, and the years of labor that went into making each rug. The value of a Persian carpet is determined by various factors, such as authenticity, quality of materials, fineness of the knots, and beauty of colors and design. The variety of carpets and rugs in Iran is enormous. Some are considered highly precious and valuable, while others are machine-made and not so expensive. The handmade rugs and carpets of the nomads have always been treasured in Iran. Their distinguishing features, especially their amazing level of quality, has made them very special. Nomadic rugs are woven by nomads or semi-settled tribes of people. They represent the simplest and earliest form of weaving. Almost all nomadic weavers employ horizontal and portable looms, unlike village and urban weavers who work on vertical looms. Rugs are generally woven to a pre-planned pattern, but rural rugs are based on designs that generate from the imagination of the weaver. They have ancient motifs that have been passed down families through the generations.
The Kheshti design is one of the oldest and most important designs that the Bakhtiari people weave. In each square, an element from nature catches the eye. The cypress and the pine tree reflect resistance. The weeping willow portrays the modest spirit of the people. And the flowers and the birds, they all reflect life and birth.
Rural carpets have been made in nearly every possible variation and for a wide range of uses. Examples include the gabbe, gilim, and jojim. Gabbe is a simple yet whimsical handmade rug traditionally woven by Qashqai weavers, people living near the Zagros Mountains in southern Iran. Traditionally used as a sleeping rug, They have geometric patterns as their main design. A gilim is produced by tightly interweaving the warp and weft strands of the weave to produce a flat surface with no pile. Joajim is a two-sided flat weave comprising narrow warp-faced stripes sewn together. They are two-sided as they were originally woven for bed covers to protect from the extreme cold in the tribal tent.
Nature has always been the main source of inspiration for the nomads, and although each region in the country has its own certain motifs, all the carpets woven by the nomads have one thing in common, and that is the use of bold and daring colors which reflect the bold and courageous spirit of the people.
It's all about the beauty of blending colors and creating a harmonious composition. The nomads use natural dyes made from natural materials such as vegetables and plants to produce the most luminous and warm shades. The designs of rural carpets and the story behind each one of them is rooted in history. Some of them date back to 1,000 years ago. The Turkmen people who live in northeastern Iran weave wonders in their rugs. The hand-woven rugs and carpets of the nomads are the embodiment of timeless art, beauty, and elegance. A world of artistic magnificence nurtured for thousands of years. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
The name that's reminiscent of one of the richest and most vivid arts and handicraft in the world. Iran, a name that embodies at least 5,000 years of culture and tradition that has matured and flourished under the influence of Mother Nature. You can see stone lions all over Charmahal-e Bakhtiari. You're probably familiar with the guardian lions of China, or Shi, as the Chinese call them. Some say that she originated from the Persian word shir, meaning lion. You see, China didn't have any lions, and just like dragons, they were mythical creatures. It's believed that lions were first presented to the Han court as a gift by the representatives of the king of Parthia, and after a while were popularly depicted as guardian lions, whereas stone lions had existed in Persia long before that. This street in the city of Hafsherjan has been home to stonemasons for centuries.
There are some crafts you can't master overnight. The skills required are passed down over the years from father to son and from master to disciple. How to use your tools to create the perfect groove. In reality, this is an art.
To sit in one location for hours, chiseling away at the stone requires patience and, above all, love of the craft. It's the fire of passion that keeps them going. The second material that's widely used in Iranian handicraft is metal, a wondrous material, resilient yet malleable under the skillful strokes of a master's hammer. Here in Iran, the art of Ghalamzani reached its peak during the 12th century, when the Seljuk became masters at working metals. What you see is the result of centuries of knowledge that has been passed down through the generations. To an untrained eye, creating such grooves may seem like an easy task, but I beg to differ. This is far from easy.
The intricate process of creating each piece requires extensive skill, talent, and of course, patience on the artist's part.
قلمزنی برخلاف تصوراتی که از فقط کار اصفهان نیست استان چهارم آل بختیاری هنرمندان خیلی خوبی داره برای این عرصه حرف برای گفتن خیلی داره توی عرصه هنر قلمزنی
To be able to revel in the aesthetics of the East is both enjoyable and educating. To show you more, we decided to head towards a small village in the city of Ben. The tiles are formed by gluing thin stripes of wood, cow bone, and gold wire together, forming a cylinder. It's only after the cylinders are cut vertically that the patterns emerge. Iran is rich in handicraft. Sharing your love of art and design as you visit the usual haunts in Iran, the street corners and markets, the studios of new and old local artists, and craft boutiques, I guarantee that the hours will pass as if they were mere minutes. This is Gulnar Fonidi for Iran.
You'll see, oh, is this real?